This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People think, oh, solar means I don't need to be on the grid. But if you look at what actually is the case, every model, every scientific paper, every study by the Department of Energy of how to get the most clean energy in the US at the lowest cost says you have to build a big grid.
Whether or not we use the name Green New Deal to describe a set of aggressive long-term policies that will help humanity in the fight against climate change, most rational people agree that the status quo is completely unacceptable. The potential of a Green New Deal is that it could pave the way for some great minds to devise concrete proposals for reducing greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with one of those great minds, Ramez Nam, a futurist and technologist who's crafted his own sort of Green New Deal. We delve into the nuts and bolts of Nam's proposal and the problems it's trying to solve as he makes the case for why we may actually see bipartisan support for such a proposal. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ramez Nam. He is the co-chair of Energy and Environment at Singularity University, and he's a writer, investor, and speaker on clean energy. Ramez, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's terrific to have you. I've followed your work for quite some time now, and I was very pleased to read your ideas on the Green New Deal.
Thanks.
Something that you have embraced and have thought about more than most Americans, for sure. So why don't you first kind of give us your bio real quickly, if you can.
Yeah, I'm an immigrant kid, came to the U.S. from Egypt at the age of three. I worked in software for a long time at Microsoft for 13 years. I've written science fiction novels, but now what I spend my time on really is energy and climate. So since about 2009, 2010, that's been the main focus. So I'm a public speaker. I talk to business audiences about how clean energy is inevitably going to win, how it's dropping in price and is going to disrupt fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas, and why it's in their selfish best interests, in addition to being in the interests of the planet and all of us, for them to get behind the future, get on board with the future train, as it were. And that's led me to working with startups and investing in startups, and it's led me to putting forth some ideas on policy to help that transition go faster as well.
Well, let's dig into some of the policies that you espouse in your piece that I read originally on TechCrunch, and we'll link to that on Sea Change Radio. It's entitled How to Decarbonize America and the World. Well, why don't we first talk about the Green New Deal in terms of our obligation to the world to focus on this on a bigger scale than on a state's level?
Well, it's both an obligation and an opportunity. So, I mean, climate change is real. Climate change is probably not going to end the human race. There's a lot of, doomsday stuff out there, but it's real and it's serious, and it causes massive, problems for us in America already. Up here in the Pacific Northwest, in Seattle, where I am, we've had, large forest fires, and obviously California had a massive fire season, and some of that is climate change. But the U.S. can't solve it alone. We're the biggest contributors to climate change so far, to making the planet warmer, but now the rest of the world is industrializing. So we're only 15% of the world's emissions in 2015, and probably even less now. So the way that I think about this is a little bit different. A lot of people think about, America's policy is about decarbonizing America, and China's policy is about decarbonizing China, and Brazil's policy is about decarbonizing Brazil. But when you look at what's actually happening around the world, that's not how it's worked. What's happened is that countries have passed policies that have pushed solutions forward, like Germany created policies that pushed solar and wind forward. And what that did was it created a new industry, and that industry had something like a Moore's Law inside of it. So the cost of solar panels has dropped by a factor of more than 350 over the last 40 years. The cost of electricity from solar, large-scale solar installations, has dropped by a factor of 10 in the last decade. And that really got started by Germany subsidizing solar and wind and helping to scale those industries and bring down the price. And so that policy impact didn't stay with Germany. It impacted the entire world, because now everybody could buy solar cheaper. And so now this fiscal year, since July 1st, what we have is the vast majority of new power generation deployed in India is solar. And that's a little bit because of India's policies, but it's a lot to do with Germany's policies and then American policies and then China getting into the solar game. All of that drove up the scale of solar, and every doubling of scale of solar drops the price by 30%. So this innovating and making the clean technologies in all of these areas, electricity, ground transportation, industry, agriculture, all of it, in making those clean options the cheapest and best options, makes them irresistible to other countries to deploy them as well. So that's the lever that we have.
Did you mean to say Moore's Law or Wright's Law there?
Well, so what I said was Moore's Law because everybody knows it, but Moore's Law is probably a special case of something called Wright's Law that people don't know as well. Wright was an economist of sorts in World War II in the U.S. War Department who found that every doubling of scale of U.S. military aircraft production brought down the cost by a consistent percent, about 16%. And when we look back in time, we found that with the Ford Model T, every doubling in scale of volume of Model T production brought down the cost. And we look at actually semiconductors and transistors, we find that Wright's Law actually is a better fit than Moore's Law, or it's sometimes called just the learning curve or the learning rate. And you look at solar power, wind power, batteries, electric cars, all of them have this phenomenon that as you increase the size of the industry, as you double the scale in solar, every doubling of scale brings down cost 30%. Because those companies that are selling product get revenue that they can then use to mostly to make the manufacturing process more efficient, to make it less energy, less labor, less raw materials going into each new solar panel that they're making. And that's what brings down the price for everybody.
And as you write in your piece, we have momentum on the electricity and transportation front. We are making huge strides in with solar and wind and electric cars, but that's only one piece of the puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you look at the global carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions, you can divide it kind of into four quarters. One quarter is electricity, and that's where we have the most in the way of solutions. We're not there yet, but solar and wind and batteries are on their way to being the cheapest source of energy, of electricity, everywhere on the planet in the next decade, more or less. The next quarter is transportation, and there on the ground transportation, EVs we think will be cheaper than internal combustion engine cars on a purchase price basis in 3 years from now. And then they'll keep getting cheaper, and the same will happen with electric trucks and electric semis and so on. So there, we're a little bit behind where we are in electricity. We're making progress.
And also autonomous vehicles, right?
Autonomous vehicles are actually key, because even if EVs were electric vehicles were 100% of new car sales today, the fleet turnover in the U.S. is about 20 years, and globally it's more like 25, 26 years. So it would take that long to age out the last gasoline cars. But if we get autonomous electric taxis, basically, those could cost a quarter of what an Uber costs today. And that would mean that people probably still own their old gasoline car. They'd, you know, have the car seats for the kids in it. They'd save it for when they go on a long trip. But their daily commute, their short trips would just turn into like calling these ultra cheap, emissionless, silent, little autonomous electric vehicles. And in fact, if you made them two-seaters, it'd be more like a tenth the price of a current Uber. And then it's irresistible, right? But the harder ones, I mean, in transportation, we have some hard things. Ships are hard and planes are really hard, but each of those is just 2% of global emissions. We have to tackle them eventually. But the harder ones that are big are industry and building heat And so those together are about a quarter of emissions. Building heat's like 6%, and industry is like steel and cement. Each of those are 5 or 6%. And making, you know, manufacturing, making chemicals and plastics. So that together is like a quarter of global emissions, and we've done very, very little work there. And then probably the hardest is another quarter, the last quarter of emissions, is agriculture and land use change, which really comes down to mostly it's about livestock and deforestation.
Yes, you write that we need to be more afraid of cows than coal.
I am more afraid of cows than coal. If you add up, like, not just what the cows, the methane burps are some, but the amount of land that we use to feed cows, the fertilizer that goes into that, the energy that goes into that, and the amount of forest that we clear globally for grazing animals, that is much scarier to me than coal right now.
Since it costs a lot to win, even more to lose, you and me about to spend some time wondering what to choose. Goes to show you don't ever know why each card you play, play it slow. Wait until that deal comes round. Don't you let that deal go down. No, no, no.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to technologist Ramez Nam. So, Ramez, some of the ways that you propose in a hypothetical Green New Deal to tackle the double-headed monster of agriculture and industry in terms of clean energy solutions, you propose that we kind of inject a lot more agency to agencies like the Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, or ARPA. In a Ramez Nam-led ARPA, Department of Agriculture, what would their mandate be in terms of trying to transform our agriculture in this country?
Yeah, so we have this, you know, we have this thing called DARPA that everybody knows, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is the military's research arm, if you will. And that's an outgrowth of something that was just called ARPA, which is what invented the internet, ARPANET, right? So it's that model has done some cool stuff. And then under President Obama, we created ARPA-E for energy that has funded early work and cool new technologies and energy storage and solar and a bunch of things. And so I'm proposing on the ag side an ARPA Ag, ARPA A, call it, ARPA for Agriculture in the Department of Agriculture. It's the same thing, that it funds, it writes grants to people in academia or in startups or in existing companies to do, you know, innovative research that they can commercialize to do a few things. Grow more food on the same land. That's boosting crop yields. Reduce inputs that we need. Inputs are fertilizer, water, pesticides, fuel. Make this, increase the efficiency of the use of those, like make new plants that don't need as much nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrogen fertilizer decomposing on the ground is about 4% of the world's carbon emissions. Manure decomposing on the ground is, you know, more than that, actually. And then three, reduce emissions from farms. So what are farm emissions? Well, farms have soil loss, water loss, nitrogen runoff that goes into streams and rivers and creates algae blooms in the Gulf of Mexico, NOx, nitrogen oxides that are a terrible greenhouse gas, methane from cows, carbon dioxide from the fuel use, and so on. So they'd work on basically better seeds, new technologies for having plants that would, you know, use nitrogen more efficiently, or like some plants today, legumes like peas or clover suck nitrogen out of the air themselves. Add feed additives or plants you could feed cows that would reduce their methane emissions. And then use that to both benefit American farmers, but also to spread around the world. So that the deforestation that's happening now in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, so that farmers there have better options. So they can grow more food on the land they have with less cost and less negative effects, and reduce the pressure to chop down forest to be able to make a life for themselves.
And now let's look at what you propose for ARPA-I. What would the industrial arm of this pursuit entail?
ARPA-I would probably just be ARPA-E. ARPA-E really, you know, the ARPA in energy and the DOE really has the remit already for all sorts of energy use, including energy use in industry, and they've done some stuff there. But we could do a lot more. So, you know, we use fossil fuels in industry to just make direct heat to do some things like making cement or certain manufacturing processes, or we burn coal to help reduce iron to turn it into steel. And so ARPA-E would work on groundbreaking research that is commercializable, that would turn into American startups that could export stuff to the world, that would electrify those processes that currently use direct heat, or find clean sources of heat, like imagine solar thermal. We have big mirrors that reflect sunlight onto a central tower. Those can get to the same temperatures that we use in a high heat industry, or cheaper ways to make hydrogen out of solar electricity or wind electricity and to use it in the place of natural gas. And then there we'd also, you know, create some incentives for industry to deploy such technologies, you know, give some tax breaks and tax credits to industries that switch from burning gas or coal or oil to electrification or clean heat. And if I'm building a skyscraper and if I buy carbon neutral cement instead of cement that releases a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, give me a tax credit for that too. Create some demand to help scale these industries after we've invented them.
Now that we've kind of outlined the major areas that the Ramez-Nahm Green New Deal would have, why don't we talk about its viability politically? I mean, just the discussion of a Green New Deal was a lightning rod for Republicans who were telling people that they're going to make hamburgers illegal. So we're dealing with fairly irrational actors, but you look at it through a more optimistic lens. You say that bipartisan climate policy is possible, and there are some facts that you cite to back it up.
Yeah, everybody gets mad at me when I say this for some reason, but you know, in 2015, under President Obama, but with a Republican majority House and a Republican majority Senate, the tax bill they signed did something that the solar and wind industries have wanted for a long time. We have these solar and wind tax credits, and they'd been expiring every year, and then 6 months into the year, they'd get recreated, basically, or re-extended. And it was just ratcheting the industry up and down. It was terrible, right? Like, nobody could plan. And so the Republicans gave a five-year plan of a long stretch out of the solar and wind tax credits, and then a gentle phase out, if you will. And then in 2017, with Donald Trump as president, the Republicans could have undone that in 2017 or 2018. They didn't. Donald Trump sent a budget to Congress asking for a major reduction in clean energy research in the DOE, in the Department of Energy. Instead, the Republican House and Senate sent him a budget that had the largest ever increase in research dollars for clean energy research in the U.S. since the initial creation of it, of that agency in 2008. So climate is really politically polarizing, but clean energy and clean industry and clean agriculture are not. So if you can let go a bit of you know, having to win on the climate point and just say to a Republican senator or congressperson, hey, you're from a Midwestern state, and you know, the biggest wind states in the U.S., Texas is the number one state for wind power in the U.S., and the wind corridor in the U.S. goes, you know, Texas up to Montana, Nebraska, over to Iowa, and those are pretty much all Republican states, right? Say, we want to do some more stuff with wind in the U.S., and it's going to benefit the farmers and ranchers in your districts that lease their land to wind turbine developers, right? I mean, they still use it. The cows graze right up to the wind turbines in these ranches. And then that Republican in Congress is like, yeah, I see how this helps my district. Okay, I'm going to vote for it. I'm not going to sign on to a, you know, blank check, quote, Green New Deal, but I'm going to vote for this thing that helps my district. Or you say, we're going to create an agency that's going to create, you know, this research that's going to reduce the need for inputs on American farms. Well, guess what? At the kitchen table, if you talk to a farmer in America, they've only got a few levers, right? And one of them is they've got to reduce the costs of all this fertilizer and pesticide and so on that they're buying and fuel. And so if you can help them do that, you save them money, you've made them money. And that's a benefit to American farmers. So I believe carrots are much easier to pass than sticks. I mean, we can talk about a carbon tax. I've worked on a carbon tax initiative, citizen ballot initiative in my home state here. It failed. The next one failed, even in a blue state of Washington. So nationally, I think we're just way more likely to get people acting on climate by talking about clean rather than climate, and by using more honey than vinegar and more carrot than stick.
And connecting the dots with another point that you make elsewhere in your piece, How to Decarbonize America and the World, you talk about how there's been tremendous gains in the transmission line space. And connecting the dots with what you were talking about earlier, the Republican states, these wind states in Montana and Texas and Wyoming, places where there's a lot more space, they could actually become vital to America's grid in a lot of ways if these transmission line hurdles are overcome. But what are those hurdles?
Yeah, so that's a great, great question. I love this question because if you look, people think, oh, solar means I don't need to be on the grid. But if you look at what actually is the case, every model, every scientific paper, every study by the Department of Energy of how to get the most clean energy in the U.S. at the lowest cost says you have to build a big grid. Because weather is less correlated with distance. So you might have a period where there's like, it's just not windy at all in the eastern seaboard, but it is windy in the Midwest. Or the sun is, it's not very sunny in Florida because of weather patterns, but it is sunny in Texas or the Southwest, right? And so that gives you protection against that, and it lets you bring in the best wind and wind peaks in winter. The best wind from the Midwest and from offshore wind on the coast eventually in places like Texas and the Great Plains, really more than the Midwest, and the best sun from the Southwest and the West and the South, right, and merge those. And so in China, they're doing it. If you look, I show sometimes a map of China of how sunny it is, and it's bright red and deep orange in the far west inland, but it's sort of like a yellow to green, not very sunny on the coast. And all the load, all the electricity demand in China is on the coast, from Beijing down to Shanghai, down to Shenzhen, where your iPhone is made. That's where the electricity demand is. So China's built this massive ultra-high voltage DC grid that on the map, it's really clear. It just takes electricity from the places where it's sunniest and windiest and moves it to the coast. And the longest of those, I think it's the Urumqi to Shanghai line, is 3,400 kilometers long, 2,100 miles long. It's 90% efficient, and it adds maybe a penny or two to the cost of electricity. If you did that in the U.S., that would extend from New Mexico to New York. And solar farms in New Mexico could be powering New York in winter, when it's not sunny in New York, but there's still sun in New Mexico, and 2 hours with the sun is set in New York.
But the problem is NIMBYism, isn't it?
The problem is NIMBY. The problem is getting the rights of way at both the state level and the property level, property owner level, to build that. So what I propose is, I call it now the U.S. Federal Interstate Energy Highway. And I'm not the first person to suggest something like this. But let's use the rights of way that we already have for federal interstates and the rights of way we have for train rail links as well, which some people are trying to use right now. And let's say, okay, you can build a high voltage, long range transmission on these lines, because we know that they go to all the cities where the big load is anyway, and we've already got infrastructure built there.
And a system like this could kind of tackle one of the holy grails of the solar industry, which has been to try to penetrate the residential homes that are renters. And that's over a third of Americans, which have been, up till now, largely left on the sidelines of the solar revolution, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, something there also is happening, which is, I mean, most solar is utility scale solar in the U.S., but something interesting is happening in that space for renters called community solar, which is in more and more states, if you rent, or just if you live in a condo that you own, or if your house just the roof faces the wrong way, you can buy into a solar project somewhere in the same zone of your utility. And it's going to be a ground-mounted tracking solar thing. It's actually gets way more electricity per dollar spent than it would on your roof, and it's credited as if it's on your roof.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to technologist Ramez Nam. So getting back to the viability politically of something like a Green New Deal, yes, Republicans have not been as terrible to clean energy policies as a lot of people might assume. But what do we need to get this passed? And I guess as a subset of that, what do you find is the most effective way to sell something? As a fiction writer, is it easier to create stories and do this in a more direct way? Or is it better to kind of do it in a more metaphorical sense? We've seen what the crafters on the other side will do when just the idea of a Green New Deal comes out. There's plenty of stories coming out that, you know, Democrats are coming to steal your hamburgers.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to reach people where they're at, right? You can't, go to a Republican legislator and say, we're going to fix climate change with socialism, like whatever you believe, or that we're going to fix all historical inequities as part of fixing climate change. It's just not going to work, right? Now, it might scare them, though, into supporting something that is a little bit more aligned with what they understand. And so you've got to talk in terms of their values and their constituents. And so there's all these studies, actually, that show that if you talk to Republicans and you talk to them about climate change, you talk about, hey, we have to slow growth, we have to live smaller lives, or, you know, reduce our footprint, live in smaller homes, and so on, their belief in climate change is low because they don't like the policy ideas that you have. Mm-hmm. If you talk to them about, hey, we're going to fix climate change through new innovation and creating new technologies and new business opportunities, new industries that American companies can lead in, they're like 20 points more likely to say that they believe in man-made climate change afterwards, right? Like their belief in the issue is actually dependent upon what solution you give them. And so that's where the storytelling comes in.
He's a technologist and a co-chair of energy and environment at Singularity University, Ramez Nam. Ramez, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's been great.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Chris Joss, Dr. John, and Rory Block.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.